Sometimes when we try and squeeze a topic out of our brain, it's quite useful to just quickly remind ourselves of what is the reason that we're here tonight. What's the reason we look for anything like Buddhism or some spiritual pursuit? Now, of course, the whole reason we do that is because we want peace, we want happiness, we want basically we want to feel good, and we want to be at peace, we want to be at ease, we want to be happy, to be content, whatever is your definition of the kind of thing that we're all searching for inside the heart. And that is why the center or the central theme of the Buddhist teaching is the one that we should, from time to time, come back to. And sometimes we can talk about a lot of things. We can be topical and we can talk about the race riots in Sydney, or we can talk about goodness knows what else. But I find, especially in a situation like this, where really, you know, nothing particularly topical seems to come to mind, the thing that I'm straight away reminded of is you know, why do we come here? What is the heart of Buddhism? What is the heart of the Buddhist teachings? And of course, it is the meditation. It is the development, the cultivation of the mind and the body, for that matter. But the cultivation of the body, I think, is often talked about because it constitutes the practice of sila, practice of generosity, compassion, things like that, which is, of course, the foundation that we have to lay. We have to make ourselves good. We have to become good, virtuous people, kind people, to be able to feel good about ourselves, because it is only really when we start to feel good about ourselves that we can have any hope of deepening our meditation, really, isn't it? So maybe I just talk about a little bit about meditation tonight, because I think certainly in the monastic life that I've been living, it's always when I didn't have the time to meditate, even say a day like today, where I started quite early because I had to do a funeral this morning, and then we went around doing some silly shopping around and things like that. So it's a day where you don't get as much meditation in as you like, and immediately once you feel, once you get the time in the evening, once I finally went into my room this afternoon to sit, it was such a relief, it was such a nice thing to be able to sit. But because I was stupidly pressurizing myself, it wasn't really as relaxed as I finally got when I sat in this spot here tonight. Because quite frankly, it's sometimes the pressure of, as it were, almost like having to be able to meditate, because I'm supposed to give a talk afterwards, that actually presses all the right buttons for the mind to actually let go and settle down and become peaceful. And that's why I didn't even want to come out of the meditation, because I had a very nice sit just before I came out. And that's probably why meditation is at the forefront of my mind as I'm beginning to give this talk tonight. So, you know, what is meditation? And what is it? What is it all about? There's many things you can talk about meditation. There's so many kinds of meditation. In fact, the Buddha, for those of you who know what the scriptures, the Buddha taught 40 different kinds of meditation, so many different angles and aspects of meditation. But what is the heart? What is the goal? What is the essence of it all? And of course, it is the ability to, little by little, become more aware of the mind, to become aware, first of all, about of the craziness of our mind. When we start a sit meditation, sometimes we want to make the mind peaceful, and that makes the mind even more crazy, doesn't it? So even the attempt, somebody came and asked me in the monastery the other day, somebody supposed to have said, you shouldn't try to meditate. And she wanted an explanation of what that means. And of course, it's the frantic trying to meditate when we don't even know what we're supposed to be doing. And so meditation is all about the ability just to understand our mind. And what makes us tick, first of all? What is this mind? And if you just ask a simple question like, well, what is the mind? And sometimes people come up with all sorts of ideas. And the mind is that which thinks, and the mind is whatever else people can come up with. But the basic function, I always say when I'm asked about that, is always it's just to know. And the mind is that which knows. And the mind is the ability to be aware, to know. The thing is, when we talk about knowing, that we all know that we have a craving to know, the craving to experience things. But the thing is, when we talk about knowing, we talk about knowing things out there in the world. And that is the world of the senses. We want to know beautiful sights. We want to know beautiful sounds. We want to know beautiful smells. And we want to know beautiful tastes. And we want to know beautiful touches. So the knowing of the world is not quite the knowing that really constitutes the mind. These are just various objects that the mind can take up. The mind can go out into the world, as it were, through these five senses of the body to know and experience and take in experience through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and of course thinking. The mind's internal conversations, ideas, concepts, brilliant ideas. So we are all here in this world because we like to experience, we like to know. But very few of us know what this knowing is by itself. We know things, we know the world out there. But very rarely have we got the chance to turn that knowing back, as it were, onto itself. To allow the knowing to just become more and more simple. So that not the objects of the world or the objects that we can know become important, but the knowing itself, as it were, begins to manifest. Or first of all, the objects of the mind, of the knowing, become more subtle. Because as we turn away from the gross experiences and actually begin to give the mind more subtle objects to know, already that feels quite different. But for most people, the knowing is inextricably, or whatever the word is, connected with doing things as well. And that is why when we start to meditate, most people, when they actually start to give the mind just one object to know, be it the breath or be it a concept like loving kindness or compassion or whatever else you might take up, or the repetition of a verse or of a mantra, to allow the mind to settle down on one object first of all. Because to jump to the knowing itself straight away is very difficult, isn't it? So we have to, as it were, start giving the mind progressively more refined objects, first of all. But the thing is, once we start doing that, once we start to simplify the objects of our mind, we quickly find out that we always want to do things as well. And so most people, when they start to meditate, there comes a time when the mind does become quite peaceful. But then what happens is, because they're so used to doing things, that to simply just know is not enough for them to stay awake. And so they fall asleep. So just knowing without doing, for most people who are used to, go out there into the world and doing things, is very, very difficult. Yeah? And so we have to, first of all, appreciate the ability to, give the mind more subtle, more sublime, more refined objects. And that's very difficult because the mind is quite used to having many objects through many different senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. So getting to know the mind is not an easy thing. And it is something that is very, very difficult for most people to do. Because what they have to do is basically to stop doing. But people don't want to stop doing, because we're attached to doing, we're attached to controlling. We want to control what we experience, we want to control what we know. At least we want to control our mind and do things in the mind. We want to think, we want to contemplate, we want to judge, to evaluate, to reflect. Some people who are not perhaps very sensual they might not be very physical, but they might be very attached to their conceptual things, the concepts in the mind. And they are the thinkers, the philosophers, the ones who, find it quite easy to stay at home and not go out, but they have to entertain themselves on the level of thinking. And they have to fantasize or write little stories in their mind to keep themselves entertained. And so being used to those kinds of things, the meditation is not an easy thing by any means. And so, but because it is at the heart of the Buddhist teachings, the very core of the Buddhist teachings is about the cultivation, the development of the mind. As you know, the little statue or the statue outside of the Buddha that we have, the little saying that is on there is to refrain from evil, to do good, and to purify the mind, which is basically, as it were, like Buddhism in a nutshell. So the purification of the mind, first of all, has to be on the level of meditation, in the sense that we can start to still the mind, to make the mind peaceful. And to be able to make the mind peaceful, to make the mind still, we have to educate ourselves, first of all, about the importance of it. If we don't have the incentive to make the mind peaceful, if we don't know what we're doing it for, then it becomes very difficult. And of course, in the world out there, there's not all that much support, is there? If we tell most people in our workplace or most people out there that we meditate, then they don't really know what that really means, and there's not all that much support. Yeah. But if we understand that it is the mind that we really have to train in order to liberate ourselves from suffering, to develop any kind of wisdom that frees us from our, first of all, petty attachments, and then gradually, little by little, from those deep-rooted attachments that keep us, stuck in samsara, then we get the incentive if we really look and contemplate. And that's why the Buddha very wisely made it a priority to understand what he called the first noble truth of suffering. And it is something that people, even good Buddhists, and sometimes they still run away from suffering. By which I don't mean that we have to create any suffering, especially for us. I mean, there's enough suffering already. We don't have to create any, but we have to pay attention to it, rather than running away from it. Most people run away from suffering all the time, trying to achieve happiness, rather than actually looking at, say, for instance, something like restlessness in the mind, or dullness, or boredom, or fear, or jealousy. All these kind of things that are there in the mind and that come up and that run the show, you know, from time to time. Those things, if we look at them, we contemplate them. You know, we contemplate death, like this morning, once again, had him do another funeral. Yeah? Although it was perhaps one of the most refreshing funerals I've ever been to. It was a Western person who died, who actually came to Nolamara, Michael something or other Dury, for those of you who remember him. I did remember his face, but I don't think I've ever spoken to him. But anyway, he was a Buddhist, and the people who came, the people who spoke, it was incredible how well they spoke and how refreshingly honest and straight from the heart it all was, and there was hardly any tears, and it was a really good funeral, as it were. And people really came to terms with death, which is very rare to see, and it's very beautiful to see someone going, and then the people around him are actually dealing with it in a very skillful way. And so dealing with those aspects of life in a skillful way is what the Buddha meant when he said that, you know, we have to comprehend, we have to understand suffering, because that is what gives us the incentive to want to understand this thing which we call the mind, which when purified leads us to the end of suffering. Otherwise, there's no chance, there's no hope. And so to get to know the mind, we have to, like I say, have that foundation, of course, and we have the foundation of virtue, that quality of non-remorse, feeling good about ourselves. And then we have the ease, we have the sense of peace, we have the freedom to relax and give the mind just one object to play with. And the difficulty with that is whatever object we give the mind, it has to be entertaining enough for the mind to want to be with it, to want to stay with it. And that's why meditation is very different for everybody. Everyone has to find out what it really is that he or she enjoys, what kind of object, what kind of meditation object is suitable. Because what we're doing in meditation, in getting to know the mind, is we're going from diversity to, first of all, to duality. The mind's diversity is the mind going out, as it were, leaking out through the senses. Now seeing, now hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and so on and so forth. That's diversity. That's the complexity. That's called papancha, which means proliferation. It's the mind going out into the world, like the branches of a tree branching out. And I still don't know who actually sent me this picture, but I... Somebody sent me a picture, must be a newspaper cutting, of this dude sitting in front his huge, two huge plasma screens with a keyboard on his lap and about three or four, whatever they were, on his right side and on his left side, and goggles and I don't know, goodness knows what else. And he was all these sort of technical things that he had. He had just about anything you could probably imagine around computer and joysticks and PlayStation and goodness knows what else he had there. And the caption just read sort of Papancha 2005, which means proliferation 2005, you know. And obviously, I'm not sure, it might have been someone who went on the retreat, because on the retreat that I gave, I said that to me the ultimate symbol of proliferation of papancha is always the computer, because there's nothing you cannot do with it these days. There's so many things you can do, and you can spend the rest of your life, you know, doing things on a computer. And I always hated the idea of ever getting into contact with these things physically. And now, believe it or not, I found myself picking up an aspect there, because I'm trying to brush up some sound, like Dhamma talks, Thai Dhamma talks, old recordings that were poorly done and things like that. So even I have gone against my principles and started to mess around on it. But certainly, luckily, we don't have these things in the monastery. But you can see, it is the papancha, it is the proliferation, it is the going out, the branching out into the world. More things to do, more things to know, to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, and to think about. Endless, endless proliferation. And that is the diversity. And what we're doing here is going 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Because we're going from this diversity, first of all, to duality. Where the knowing has, first of all, only got one object to know. One thing only. If you want to know what the mind is, you got to give that mind one object. And that's as simple as it is. But that's also as difficult as it is. If you can stay with Butto, 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 for 10 minutes, you're going to get samadhi, whether you like it or not. It's a natural process. If you stay with the breath, going in, out, in, out, in, out, in, out, in, out, with everything else disappearing, for less than 10 minutes, you get into samadhi. The mind becomes one-pointed. The mind becomes, as it were, it becomes, it goes to duality. Where the mind only has one object. But you can imagine, because we're so used to having so many objects, you know, running around all the time, the mind rebels if you try to give it just one object. And that is why we have to make that meditation interesting. That's why all the skillful means, all the tricks, all the gigs, all the skillful advice and all the kind of, you know, little tricks that, you know, the monks try and teach or whatever. It is all for that one and only purpose, to get the mind into samadhi. Whatever it takes for the mind to stay with one object for long enough to let go of everything else, that is the path. That is what we're aiming for. And if we understand that, on the level of principle, first of all, at least we know what we're supposed to be doing. And it doesn't matter what that object is. If you want to say coffee cup, coffee cup, coffee cup, coffee cup, coffee cup, that's fine. If you get off on coffee that much, that the mind is able to stay with a coffee cup for as long as it takes to get into samadhi, then good on you. It doesn't matter. There's no trick. There's no magic mantras. There's no need for making it more esoteric than it really is, because it isn't. It's that simple. The mind is simply that which knows. That's its function. And the mind quite happily knows anything. Yeah? The mind doesn't care what it knows. Mind doesn't care what it knows. And the eye doesn't care what it sees. It's just a function. It's just a duty of an eye to see. The nose doesn't give a damn what it smells. Because it's just a duty of the nose to smell. The tongue doesn't give a damn what it tastes. The body doesn't care what it feels. And the mind doesn't care what it knows. So where's the problem? Who cares? Huh? Who cares? The mind doesn't care. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body don't care. Who cares? Who cares what we know? Huh? Huh? Who cares? Who gives a shit? Huh? No one got an answer? Man, some people coming here for 20 years. You still don't know? Anyone know in Singapore? Nobody knows. Who cares? It's greed that cares. And it's anger that cares. And where do greed and anger come from? Where does lust and aversion come from? Where does liking and disliking come from? Okay, come on now, wake up. Yeah, that's it. Ignorance, delusion, stupidity. Greed and anger, the two forces that keep us running around doing crazy things, pulling and pushing, like Ajahn Sa said, these two strong men, one on the right, one on the left, with a big string around your neck, pushing and pulling, and choking you to death. That's greed and anger. That's lust and hatred. Yeah? But the chief is delusion. Yeah? So the chief that is sitting on top of our mind, using our mind like a throne, like a king, well, actually it's not like a throne, it's more like a toilet seat. Yeah? Uses it like a delusion, uses our mind like a toilet seat. Yeah? And it's doing its business there 24 hours a day without us really knowing what's going on. Yeah? Because it's true that the mind doesn't care what it knows. The mind is quite happy to know anything. Yeah? And of course the senses, like I say, they're just earth, air, water and fire. And it's the four elements. They don't care about anything. You can spit on the earth, you can, you know, call the earth wonderful. It doesn't matter. The earth doesn't care. The fire doesn't care. Water doesn't care. Air doesn't care. But neither does the mind. Yeah. So the vested interest, you know, in what we know, what we experience, yeah, comes through whatever level of delusion there is in the mind, which in turn, of course, produces that pushing and pulling between liking and disliking. Now it's too hot, now it's too cold, now it's just right, no, not anymore. Now we like it, now we don't like it. So what is the goal then, or what is the training then rather, is to find a way of giving the mind, first of all, something to know that is interesting enough to keep the mind's attention, interesting enough to keep the mind aware, awake. But at the same time, it has to be simple enough for the mind to be able to go from that diversity to, first of all, that duality. And if we achieve that much, then we've achieved a lot. And for those of you who were on the retreats or who are good meditators and have, you know, got to the stage where the mind quite happily simply knows the breath, where the breath becomes, as it were, effortless. And I made much of that during the retreat I taught recently. The state of effortlessly knowing one object, where we are no longer controlling the breath, where we are no longer manipulating the breath, where we no longer desire the breath to be one thing or another, and perhaps most importantly, where we no longer are averse to the breath being one way or another, but where we can just perfectly, happily, contentedly watch, effortlessly watch, just one breath going in, being perfectly content, not wanting anything in the whole world. That is when the meditation becomes beautiful. That's when the beautiful breath, as Ajahn Brahm very adequately calls it, manifests. Because the beautiful breath is nothing other than the breath that is being effortlessly watched by what? By the mind. Where the knowing just has one beautiful object. And what makes that object beautiful is nothing other than our contentment. What makes the breath, or what makes anything beautiful for that matter, is nothing other than our contentment with it. If you love someone, that person becomes beautiful because you're content with them, because you like them. If you don't like someone, if you hate someone, it's because you're not content with with the situation, with the person, with what he does or she does, so on and so forth. If we contend with the object of meditation for long enough, that the watching of it becomes effortless, that's when the meditation takes off. And that is the state of mind that, you know, I hope more and more and more people are starting to get into, because that's really when you see the beauty and the joy of meditation. And there's no way that you would want to do anything else. You know, I mean, you do things, yes, but kind of, as it were, almost grudgingly, you know, because you kind of, you got to do it, you know, it's a chore, it's a job. We waste a lot of time in our lives with things that aren't really important. And it's amazing to see how much time you can waste, even in a monastery. You know, I know that for myself. I still get caught, you know, in doing little projects because I think they're important, you know. But how important are they really? You know, in the face of death, and somebody puts a 45 to your head and says, you know, a count of 10, that's the end of it. You know, what's really important at that time? You know, somebody comes and says, sorry mate, you got 3 months. Finished. So what's important? Yeah. So that is why the Buddha said, we have to contemplate suffering. And we have to look at suffering, because it is suffering that gives us the incentive to want to get the hell out of here. Yeah. Like I said to the funeral people this morning, people at the funeral, and so it's like, no one's going to get out here alive. I must have dropped that line here before. Yeah, because I like it. No one's going to get out here alive. We're all going to cark it. We're all going to die. Yeah? And we don't know when. Yeah? Things like that, contemplations like that, you know, they're very, very powerful, very, very beautiful. And they're not things that, you know, that they're not things that the mind, or rather that delusion, wants to know, wants to hear. Yeah? If you start contemplating your death, or you start contemplating the foulness of the body, or anything like that, yeah, then this Raja, this king that is sitting on your mind, using it like a toilet seat, he's going to do anything to make you think of something else, to enjoy this wonderful world. What a wonderful world. Yeah, I guarantee you. Yeah. Because he has to do that. Or she, I don't know, I haven't met him yet. Don't want to be sexist about that. Yeah. I mean, this delusion has been sitting on this mind for, you know, eons and eons and eons. Yeah? And that delusion is not going to give in easily. Yeah? So as soon as we actually follow the Buddha's advice and start actually contemplating suffering to give us that extra little incentive to get to terms with our meditation, stop messing around and stop wasting time, then that delusion, as it were, is going to get very worried very quickly. And it's going to come up with all sorts of ingenious ideas of telling you all about the wonderful things that are so important in life. And that's where the trick is. To keep that interest going, to keep the motivation going for long enough to get that first whiff of samadhi, and that first little taste of freedom. Where the first level of purification is actually reached, because the mind is first of all purified from the hindrances. It's purified from sensory desire, from ill will, from sloth and torpor, from restlessness and remorse, and from doubt. And those five villains that are controlling the mind 24 hours all the time, once they are shut up for a short while, then that is the first level of purification of the mind on a temporary basis. But is that what we have to aspire to? And it's finding the incentive and finding the ways, because it's the carrot and the stick kind of thing, isn't it? I mean, if we just give ourselves the stick all the time, then and we don't get the results, then, you know, we get all fed up, and, you know, we get kind of, you know, dejected or whatever the word is, and then we feel we can't do it and we're hopeless and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we have to also, of course, use the carrot where we actually keep inspiring ourselves. Yeah? And that's why we need to, you know, come here on a Friday night, listen to Dhamma, hopefully to get a bit of inspiration, come away, you know, a little bit more fired up and inspired about Buddhist practice, you know. But that is only a part of it. You have to find your own things that uplift you, inspire you. And to find out what is your temperament, what is your character, what are the things that make you, you know, want to put in the hours, want to put in the effort to, you know, practice. And so finding that incentive and maintaining that continuity, because it is the continuity of being able to sustain, you know, mindfulness, you know, over a long period of time, that really leads to samadhi. If you look at the Eightfold Path, the Sammā Samādhi, the last factor of the Eightfold Path, is the pinnacle, is the apex of the Eightfold Path, yeah, before it leads into liberation and freedom. Yeah. But before is actually the factor of right mindfulness. Yeah. So we have to have that continuity of mindfulness, and we have to maintain that. And that is what is so difficult, isn't it? To, you know, maintain that ability to remain in the present moment, to be able to sustain that mindfulness and awareness with whatever we're doing. And again, if we know the trick, if we know the principle, it becomes a lot easier. And that is, of course, the fact that it doesn't really matter what we are aware of. The objects of our awareness, the objects of our mindfulness, as well as the objects of the meditation proper, aren't as important as our attitudes towards them. So if you understand that it is more important to be mindful and fully aware than to have your particular choice, to be aware of something that you like, then that is important, because then you can be aware of anything, even the things you don't like. Because what happens is we then more and more actually become someone who goes through life not for hunting particular experiences, but for hunting awareness with regard to whatever we experience. And so we can go through life, we can go through our day doing the things that we need to do with a smile and with a sense of, it doesn't matter what it is. It is more important that we are putting 100% of effort of being mindful and aware of the things that we are experiencing. Because there, right then, we cultivate that ability to sustain our mindfulness, to sustain our awareness on one thing, which again feeds the payoff comes when we actually sit meditation. So however much the objects of our awareness change throughout the day, if our level of commitment and attention and awareness towards those objects doesn't change, then when we go and sit meditation in the evenings, when we have the time to actually sit down and meditate formally, then the mind is right there. Mindfulness is right there. But if we, you know, go through life kind of, you know, liking this and not liking that and being pushed and pulled around and not really paying attention to the things that are, this is boring and I don't want to do this and I can't be bothered and, you know, why this and why that and why me? You know, if that's the attitude that drives us through life, then we don't actually train the mind in that quality of being aware and focused and sharp and mindful of its objects. Because if we understand that basically the mind doesn't care what it knows, like I said, but that it's just those two two gangsters of liking and disliking, based on delusion, that make us believe that we like, that there's, that it is worthy of, that one thing is more worthy of liking and the other thing is more worthy of disliking. If we don't believe in that anymore, or if we at least know in principle that is where the problem is, then we have a chance to attack that problem and to do something about it. Of course, we can't rip our hearts out and pretend from one day to the other that we're not going to like the things we've been liking for lifetimes, and we're going to love all the things that we hated. That's not what I'm trying to say. I mean, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. And that's why it is a gradual training. But if you understand the principle, then you can actually move towards that middle way of equanimity, where the mind kind of, more and more is able to bear with the things that perhaps before it didn't like. And it can also be more at ease or at peace with the things that it used to excessively crave. And so there's an evening out of that liking and disliking. The ups and downs of life become not so up and not so down. And we're a bit more at ease, we're a bit more at peace. And that is very, very beautiful when that actually happens. Because what it does is it makes us no longer so much of a slave to this liking and disliking business. The more we understand the conditioned nature of what we like and what we dislike, all these things, they come and they go, and that's all there is. One of my favorite sayings of Thanachan Ben, I don't know if there's any ties here tonight, mite kon goet mat dai. Kenanna. It's all there is. There's just things that have been born, dying. That's all there is. That's all what our life is. Things that have been come into existence, go into cessation. Things that have arisen, dying. Things that have been born, dying. That's all there is. All the time. And if we understand that, then, we get the incentive that, well, this is suffering, Whether I like it or not, it's going to end. And so why then put so much effort into controlling, manipulating, and having it our way? Why not just allow it to be, the way it wants to be? And put more effort into the actual knowing of it. So that the act of becoming aware and wisely aware of these things becomes more important than manipulating and controlling the objects of our awareness. And if we can do that, then our life just becomes so much more, peaceful, and so much more at ease, because it's no longer so important to always control the objects of our attention. We can be quite happily experiencing something that is unpleasant, because our goal is to be aware, to know, to understand, to see, and to be free from the slavery that we've been, in for all these eons, And it becomes fun. It becomes fun. Once we get our first little bit of, as it were, freedom, from being always, pushed and pulled around. And once that mindfulness gets a little bit more sharp, it gives a sense of freedom. It gives a sense of freedom, a sense of ease. And with that comes more inspiration and more incentive to put more effort into the practice. And because we actually see we're getting results, and it's worthwhile. So meditation no longer just becomes, a kind of, like a little ritual, where, we come here on a Friday night and we all sit down nicely and now we're going to meditate for half an hour. you know, it becomes more than that. You know, meditation really becomes the heart of our life. I remember, and of course this was way back when I didn't even know what I was talking about. I remember one of the first cards, I stopped writing back to Germany when I was in Thailand very quickly. I stopped writing all kinds of, any kind of mail. But the first inspired postcards that I wrote in the very first months that I was in Thailand in the monastery. Yeah. And I remember one line I wrote was, you know, instead of instead of meditating in your life, you know, make your life a meditation. And of course, at that time, it was just a nice, it sounded good, you know, but I didn't know what I was talking about, you know. And I still don't know, you know, fully, but I got more of an idea of what it means, because obviously, because once the meditation really becomes the heart of your life, once you understand what it actually is, yeah, that's why they have that word in the Pali is citta bhavana, means the cultivation or the development of the mind, the purification of the mind, like it says on that Buddha statue outside. Yeah. But that purification, again, comes in stages. Yeah. It comes in stages. It doesn't sort of, you know, it's no one coming with a magic wand and bingo, now you're enlightened kind of thing. You know, it's a very gradual thing. And it starts, you know, with, you know, taking everything in, everything that the world has to offer, everything that we have to experience, is all food for the heart. It's all stuff that once we use it for developing wisdom and understanding, it's all good stuff. And that way we're a lot more free. We're not so petty. Yeah? We don't have to have things, you know, always one way. But then, of course, once the mind gets to a point where it has that duality, where it came, first of all, from the diversity to duality, that's not the end of meditation, of course. Because if we're talking about, you know, right meditation or right concentration, samma samadhi, the eighth factor there of the Eightfold Path, then we have to, you know, look at what that actually means. And the right concentration or the right samadhi is, you know, in the Buddha's description, is the one, the complete one-pointedness of mind, where the mind not only achieves that beautiful sense of duality, you know, where the first sense of effortlessness, effortlessly watching something, effortlessly knowing something, that is achieved when we have that duality. But then actually, we have to achieve that unity, the unification of the mind, and where the mind really, not only, where the mind literally turns back on itself, where the mind begins to see itself, know itself. And that is the path. All those you know, great teachers those monks that you may have read about, they all say that it is the seeing of the mind which is the path. And that is the attainment of Samma Samadhi, where the mind actually begins to see the mind, where the mind sees itself. Because right now the mind is obscured by the senses and the hindrances. Desire and aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, those things are the obstructions to seeing the mind. But not only that, but it's the five senses as well. So the mind's purification, as it says on that Buddha statue out there, on the level of samadhi, is the purification also from the five senses, where the mind, as it were, for the first time, leaves the world of the five senses and actually experiences the world of the mind, where the mind experiences the mind. Where the mind sees itself, where the knowing, as it were, converges on itself. But again, that is also gradual, because the stages of samadhi are still. Sometimes people say that it is the cutting away or the cutting away at the mind, but really, it's the object still. Isn't it? I mean, it's still the objects that we're cutting away. It's still things like, you know, first of all, when the mind really unifies, the only thing that you can possibly tell anybody if it happens, is if you want to describe it to anybody, is just bliss. It's just happiness. It's just sheer bliss. And you're blissed out of your skull for I don't know how long it takes, for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on the degree of samadhi you've achieved. And you're blissed out. And that's really all you can say when you come out. But it's only when you deepen those stages of meditation that you actually realize that there are different degrees of bliss. And that even bliss can disappear. Because on the highest level of those unifications of the mind, even happiness disappears. And there's just equanimity. So even happiness is still an object of the mind. And mind you, even equanimity is still an object of the mind. So you're still dealing with refined objects of the mind. So the mind really letting go of all those objects, complete letting go, all around, 100%, total letting go, reserving nothing, where you still claim a self or a me or a mind. That's what's called enlightenment. That's the real purification of the mind, is where all objects have been completely relinquished. And that is where the mind attains liberation. That is the purification of the mind. And that is where the path, you know, culminates. But of course, like I said, it is important to realize that it is something that happens in stages. And so once we have the incentive to go and walk that path, and once we have developed the skillful means to maintain the interest and the joy and the happiness, to find those things, those aspects in the mind that keep us motivated, then, you know, we never want to do anything else. We never really want to waste any time doing anything else. We want to spend more and more time meditating. Quite naturally seems to be running out there at the moment. I don't think there's much to add. If people have any questions or comments, I'm happy to answer some more questions. If people have any, please feel free. Remember, the Buddha said, if you don't ask questions, you're going to get more stupid the next time. Sorry, I didn't quite get that. Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the object. If the object is an unpleasant object, then if you can stay with it, the important thing in understanding or knowing suffering, In the context of what you're just saying, is that you actually know the difference between that which knows and the object that is being known. So once actually an unpleasant object arises in the mind, and you can stay with that without the mind getting restless, that's already very, very good. But it presupposes, it takes a lot of mindfulness for the mind to actually be able to stay with an unpleasant object without rejecting it or trying to get away from it. Yeah? But what you're saying is right. The seeing of suffering, the real seeing or understanding of suffering comes through actually paying attention to it, looking at it, taking an interest in it. Because if we run away from it all the time, we never see it. If we never see it, we never contemplate it or look at it. And if we never really contemplate it, then we can never really understand it. And if we don't understand it, we can never be free from it. So it is important that we don't run away from it too quickly. Yeah? So obviously there are degrees of suffering, degrees of pain, for instance, yeah, that it would be unwise to just endure. Because the point is not to endure suffering, which sometimes we have to do that as well. So endurance is a very high spiritual quality. Yeah? So I'm not putting down endurance either. But here what I'm trying to emphasize is that we take up an object with the desire of understanding it. Yeah? So the aim is always at understanding it, seeing it. And one of the first things on the way to understanding suffering is to see it as an object. Yeah? Because the moment that you can know, or that which knows, is one thing, and the thing which is being known is an object, already there, you know, at least theoretically, you can identify, well, it's not me, it's not mine. If I can know it, it's not me. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah.